Okay, well, it's a great pleasure to be here, and thank you to Vimon for setting up this invitation. I'm here because I've been interested in Legge-Gog inequalities for a few years now, and occasionally mentioned to Vimon about this interest, and we discussed some possible experiments which have now finally been done, or they're in the process of being doing. So this is very exciting for me to come here and actually talk about the theoretical work I've done in the face of experiments that have actually been carried out. So I'm specifically interested in decisive tests for microrealism of Legge-Gog type, and also with new types of measurement protocol which implement the non-invasiveness required to do these sorts of tests. Well, I'm not going to give some background as to what the Legge-Gog framework is all about. Legge-Gog framework tests a notion called macroscopic realism, which in simple terms is the moon really there when no one looks? Einstein's famous question. More precisely, can you think of a quantum system as following a definite trajectory? Or what's related to this is, can macroscopic systems exist in superposition states? This is the question that Legge-Gog were first interested in. These questions are actually related to the general issue of classicality conditions in quantum theory. My background, as some of you know, was in the decoherent histories approach, which attempts to assign probabilities to histories. And from that study, one could see that there's actually a hierarchy of classicality conditions, ranging from decoherence, which is a very kind of asymptotic condition, to the Legge-Gog inequalities and macrorealism, which are perhaps the weakest notion of classicality. So Legge-Gog inequalities were designed to test an extremely weak notion of classicality, of whether one can assign probabilities to trajectories. There are other notions of macrorealism which are a little bit stronger, which go by the name of no signaling in time or coherence witness, and these I will also mention throughout the course of this talk. Well, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to review the background quantum mechanics and the Legge-Gog framework. And then the main part of the talk, I'd like to describe an extension of this framework, which creates a decisive and richer test of macrorealism, which actually has a clearer connection to Bell experiments. All along, these ideas were developed in parallel with Bell experiments, but the parallel is imperfect in parts, but although it can be improved. I'll briefly compare with some stronger conditions relating to no signaling in time, and then also talk about some alternative methods for non-invasive measurement. This is based on five papers over the last few years. I've had huge interest in this area, so enjoyed writing a lot of different things. And the current experiment is being carried out by Shayan Majidi, Hemant Katyal, and Mamala Flam at IQC, and that is testing a couple of the things that I'm going to be talking about today. Well, just so here's the outline. I'll start with some background quantum mechanics and then describe the Legge-Gog tests. And then the middle part will be focused on looking at extended Legge-Gog framework. And then at the end, I'll look at non-invasive, new possibilities for non-invasive measurements. Well, just to fix ideas, let's start with something familiar. Let's think about the EPRB experiment, where you have a pair of correlated particles and you measure them, each one in one of a pair of directions. And from that, you get a bunch of pairwise probabilities, 1, 3, 1, 4, 2, 3, 2, 4, and so on, where S is plus or minus 1. And then you look at the various correlations in these probabilities and see if you can get some understanding of where those correlations came from. Well, the pairwise probabilities always satisfy a no signaling condition, meaning that if I just measure spin 3 on its own, it doesn't matter if I measure it in conjunction with S1 or S2 and so on. These are basically mathematical conditions. Well, it's both physical, but it's also mathematical conditions, ensuring the compatibility of these different probabilities. And what we then try to do is to see if there's an underlying joint probability distribution which matches all of the pairwise distributions. Well, if we postulate that such a probability exists, and we find that the correlation functions, which are constructed in this way, must satisfy the eight CHSH inequalities, two of which have the following form, and then there's another six of the same form. So these are the, if these inequalities are violated, then no such probability exists. Now, we can actually make a stronger statement than that, which is Fine's famous theorem. And that says that the eight CHSH inequalities together with the no signaling conditions are actually sufficient conditions for the construction of the probability. So if these are satisfied, you can actually build the underlying joint probability distribution. So CHSH plus no signaling are necessary and sufficient conditions for local realism. So these are what I would call a decisive test for local realism. This is where Legit-Garg falls short a bit, and there are the gaps to be filled. Now, one could make similar statements for the three measurements, Bell inequalities, which have this form, plus another three. There's a total of four of them, plus another three of that type. And then some comments here. First of all, the existence of the underlying joint probability distribution is deduced indirectly from the partial snapshots. The whole issue about Fine's theorem is, if you have all these snapshots, does the probability exist or not? Can you just construct it? You don't actually measure it explicitly in general. I mean, this is an obvious statement here, but that distinction becomes less obvious in certain approaches to macrorealism. Actually, quantum mechanics, for instance, through the decoherence histories approach, can sometimes supply such a probability, or at least attempt to supply. The CHSH inequalities then imply that the bounds on the interference. The interference doesn't have to be zero. You can have non-zero interference and still have an underlying probability, that is, still have a hidden variables model. And this is going to be relevant in the Legit-Garg framework. So that's the background from ordinary, that is probably familiar to you from Bell experiments. So let's now look at how all that goes over to Legit-Garg tests. Well, these were first proposed in 1985 by Leggett and Garg. The whole Leggett-Garg story is about 20 or 30 years behind the Bell one, both theoretically and experimentally, by the way. They proposed to actually do sequential measurements on a single system in time, so space becomes time in these experiments. Bell inequalities test local realism. Legit-Garg tests a notion that they just call macroscopic realism, or macro realism, or MR for short. And you are warned that we are approaching an acronym-rich environment with lots of clunky nomenclature. So just to, so you don't forget any of it, I've made a convenient summary on the blackboard above. Well, macroscopic realism is broken down into three separate bits, which, if I got to reinvent this theory personally, I would have used different nomenclature, but I'm afraid we're stuck with what there is. So the first aspect of it is that the first assumption is that the system is in a definite state at each moment of time, and this is referred to as macrorealism per se, or MRPS. The second assumption is that the state can be measured without disturbing the subsequent dynamics. This is non-invasive measurability, or NIM. These two are going to be the most important acronyms to remember. We also assume there's no retrocausality, so future measurements don't affect the present state. This is often called induction, which is another slightly odd word, I believe, is sometimes confused with other things.
In this context, the word state presumably means valuation of some macroscopic observables that you're focused on.
Yes.
Not quantum state.
I have in mind some thing like a spin variable which takes a definite value. But once you get into talking about the underlying ontic models that describe these things, the idea does extend to, like in Bohm theory, you can have a wave function. But what we have in mind is a kind of mechanical view, essentially, in which there's a spin which takes a definite value.
So you set out what your macro observables are, like spin, And then definite state means definite value for those microobservables.
That's correct, yes.
And then the word state in the other two is also referring to the value of those microobservables. That,
right, it does, yep.
Good.
Okay. So these are the three assumptions. So macrorealism, the whole thing, in the broader sense, is the logical conjunction of these three things. Now, there's a nice review of Legit-Gog, Experimental and Theoretical by Emery and collaborators. I also heartily recommend the critique by Moroni and Timpson, who really penetrate to what the Legit-Gog inequalities really test. And actually, they do really clarify things on state and what sort of ontic model you're testing and so on. But I'm going to take a sort of pretty pedestrian view through that in what follows. So supposing we've assumed all of this, well, in a practical model, what's the consequence? Well, we make measurements. We have a system with a single dichotomic variable Q, takes values plus or minus one, at pairs of, we make measurements of pairs of times chosen from four, and determine four pairwise probabilities and their corresponding correlation functions for pairs of times 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, and 1, 4. So slightly different numbering to the CHSH case. So we do a measurement of pairings along these lines. Then macrorealism, that combination of assumptions implies that a joint probability distribution exists. And that, in turn, is readily shown to imply the Legit-Gog inequalities, which are basically CHSH, but just with different labeling. So a total of eight Legit-Gog inequalities. These are readily shown to be violated in quantum mechanics. If I take a simple spin model with Hamiltonian sigma x, I take Q to be a Pauli matrix in the A direction, then the correlator is just a dot product, and hence a cosine. So you see the sort of clear parallel with EPRB. They're readily seen to be violated. If we take equal time spacing, as is commonly chosen, then the inequality is reduced to something like this, which has a maximal violation of 2 root 2 at omega t is pi by 4, and with similar sorts of results for higher dimensional models. So far it does actually look quite similar, at least in outline, to the usual Bell case.
Jonathan, yep. Question. In your correlation C12, you have Q of T1 and Q of T2 plus the reverse.
Yep.
When you do an experiment, how do you do this? Measuring T1, you would have an order of T1 and T2.
You do a sequential measurement when you project onto Q1, followed by a projection onto two, so you get a two-time probability from which you compute a correlation function. So you have a correlation function which is the sum of S1, S2, and then probability of measured. So experiment determines this, joint probability.
Okay.
And then you compute this, and then what quantum mechanically you find out that it's exactly that. Which turns out it's actually independent of the ordering, as it turns out. Now, what about the non-invasiveness? This is the most sort of vexed area of the whole Legit-Gog framework. We want the first measurement in each pair to not disturb the second one. And the way that Legit and Gog propose to do this is to use a so-called ideal negative measurement. So the first time, instead of coupling the detector to both values of Q, you couple it only to one value, let's say Q equals plus one, and then say, well, if the detector doesn't register, then Q must be minus one. So classically, that would be a non-invasive procedure. This has now become the standard procedure for measuring things in a non-invasive way. The first experiments that really tested Legit-Gog thoroughly by use this method. So Georgini and collaborators, Robins et al., and also Hemant Katya and collaborators, and Ramon here in the IQC did this sort of experiment a few years ago. This procedure eliminates alternative explanations by classical models with invasiveness. So it can be shown. If you're allowed invasiveness, you can build a classical model that will reproduce the results. So it's basically like signaling models will explain Bell inequality violations. One of the difficulties with ideal negative measurements is that they still cause wave function claps. So to not register something is just as bad as to register it in quantum mechanics, because you've got a spread out wave function. That causes some complications in the interpretation. But the thing is, you're testing a macro realistic theory for which this is actually an acceptable procedure. But we might come back to that a little bit later on. Also, the measurement of the pairwise probabilities is often done using an ancilla at the first time that becomes entangled with Q at the first time. So in practice, what we actually have is two systems in an entangled state. And so you see there's reiterates the parallel with EPRB. So that is the sort of intuitive way of understanding why the EPRB situation is quite similar to the Legge-Gog situation. It's often been suggested that one could use weak measurements to actually test Legge-Gog inequalities. And the very first experiment, actually, used a weak measurement to measure the correlators. There is some question marks around this, because weak measurement is not very disturbing, but on the other hand, the effect is extremely small. So are you really doing something that's non-invasive? I personally don't believe that they actually really implement non-invasiveness in a satisfactory way, but there's still a debate about that. I think Leggett has said that also very strongly quite a few years ago. But quite a lot of the experiments use weak measurements, so there's a story in there to be still sorted out. Here's, as an aside, here's another direct connection to the EPRB case, and this does provide a satisfactory non-invasive measurement procedure. Supposing that the Legge-Gog system is half of an EPRB pair, so here's a pair A and B, and then I have some sort of magnetic field over here on the right-hand side. Here's what I do. At the first time, I measure system B, and I use the anti-correlation to discover what A is doing, so I determine that non-invasively, because these are sufficiently far apart. And then the only measurement I do on A is at time T2, after it's evolved a little bit. So I can determine QA at time T2 and QA at time T1, but making use of that correlation. So that's the ideal of what we would like a Legge-Gog measurement to be like, so that there's the invasiveness actually reduces to locality. But I think there's a guy in Santa Barbara called Martinez who's been looking at something like that. And also Justin Dressel, perhaps, had some sort of hybrid Bell Legge-Gog thing going on. So that's the sort of lengths you'd need to go to really get non-invasiveness under control to a satisfactory degree. Now some comments. Bell inequalities rule out local realism. Legge-Gog rules out certain types of hidden variable theories. There are a number of different types that Moroni and Timpson delineate. Legge-Gog really only rules out hidden variable theories, which are, loosely speaking, GRW-type theories in the limit of perfect density matrix diagonalization. So they're like classical theories that quantum mechanically would be density matrix diagonal. It doesn't rule out de Broglie-Bohm type theories, unless you can invoke some sort of locality. So there's always, in Legge-Gog situations, you can always jump up and say de Broglie-Bohm. But there's, one is defenseless against that sort of criticism. Moroni and Timpson and Bacci-Galeppi also make this point pretty strongly. So it's quite limited then compared to Bell in terms of what you can exclude. And another important difference here with the Bell case is that no signaling relations of this type don't hold in Legge-Gog tests, because you're doing sequential measurements, and the first one quantum mechanically will disturb the second one. Now, this means that Feynman's theorem doesn't hold. Legge-Gog inequalities are necessary conditions for MR, but they're not sufficient. So this is one of the things I want to show how to patch up, that there is a way around this. But it does emphasize the difference between the two different situations. So now we're coming on to the new bit, which is about decisive tests. Well, the whole issue is around doing measurements at two times and trying to maintain a parallel with Bell. The analog of no signaling in EPRB for the temporal correlations here are the so-called, more nomenclature here, no signaling in time condition first proposed by Bruckner and Koffler. And it's quite simply this: if you do a measurement at two times and sum out the first one, it should be the same as doing a measurement at the second time only without the first one being present. Now, that's not true in general in quantum mechanics. If it is, it characterizes both non-invasiveness and MRPS, because this, in an average sense, denotes non-invasiveness. And if it's true, you see, that P12 is then a probability at two times. And when it holds, all the pairwise probabilities are compatible with each other, and Fine's theorem applies. But as I've said, it's not satisfied in general in quantum mechanics. Well, nevertheless, so you've now got two choices here. One is, well, you could say, well, let's just limit ourselves to situations which are essentially set of measure zero in parameter space for which this holds. And this is what Bruckner and Koffler did, using two and three time no signaling conditions without using the Leggett-Gaug inequalities. And they said, well, let's just retire the Leggett-Gaug inequalities. We only need to look at these. I find that too much. I think you can get by with less. So my argument is that there's a different way of solving this problem and meeting Fine's theorem, but without using sequential measurements. Well, the key issue here is that we're dealing with probability distributions at two times for non-commuting observables, unlike in the Bell case. And when you have a pair of non-commuting observables, the existence of a joint probability is not guaranteed. In other words, macrorealism may fail already at the two-time case, unlike EPRB, where, I mean, it's all the two variable probabilities are always well defined. Even if a macro-realistic description does exist, then there could be a number of different ways of assigning probabilities to such pairs of observables. That's a general feature in quantum mechanics, that joint probabilities for non-commuting quantities are not unique. They depend on the type of measurement protocol and exactly how you implement the non-invasiveness requirement. So the goal then is to say, well, in general, the two-time probability will look something like this in a convenient moment expansion, where these are the averages of Q1, Q at time T1, Q at time T2. And the average of Q at time T2 could, in principle, depend on whether or not there's a measurement at the first time. Let's find alternative ways of constructing this thing which don't involve sequential measurements. Well, here's the solution: that we proceed in an indirect way. You say, well, at two times, what we actually have is a bunch of moments, average of Q at time T1 and time T2, and the correlator. And you suppose you measure all of these, respecting non-invasiveness, in three different experiments. So that way, earlier measurements can't disturb the later one, except when you're measuring the correlator, but you do that using ideal negative measurements, which will ensure non-invasiveness. And having determined these things, you say, well, let's just try and construct the two-time probability from its moments. Well, there's an essentially unique answer, which is this quantity. It's not necessarily positive, but in a macro-realistic theory, this must be true, because S and Q are plus or minus one. And if you just average that, you get precisely that Q is positive. So for a macro-realistic theory, then Q must be positive. And that actually is an if and only if. It's quite easy to see. Now, I call these things two-time Leggett-Gaug inequalities because they are identical in form to the three-time ones. It is a measure of MRPS only because we've assumed NIM, non-invasiveness, in the measurement. It's not that we don't have to check to see if it's satisfied using this quantity, unlike the usual no signaling in time condition. Most importantly, it could actually fail. So MRPS could actually fail already at the two-time case. So this is a really important difference with the Bell case. Already, just at the level of two measurements, you might not actually have a joint probability just for the two-time things. So just to kind of clarify that logically, what this means is something which I don't think was properly appreciated in earlier work on the Leggett-Gaug inequalities, which is that there are actually, I mean, I said earlier that there are different versions of MRPS, depending on which sort of hidden variable theory you have in mind. But there are also two natural different ways of thinking about non-invasiveness, and therefore different notions of macrorealism. Now, I call them piecewise and sequential. Piecewise NIM means that you do numerous experiments to measure all the moments and then try to assemble them and deduce the joint probability indirectly. So you only need invasiveness in each separate experiment. You don't need invasiveness of the whole lot together. In sequential NIM, you actually just do effectively a single experiment and then make sure that the no signaling in time conditions are satisfied. This is much, much stronger. Now, it seems to me that all Leggett-Garg experiments that have been done already use the first one. And the second one is discussed, but it has not really played a role in essentially all experiments that have been done to date. Now, each one of them produces different notions of macrorealism, which I can now just elucidate. But I really think the most important one is the first one. Yep.
In the second case, you mean just the pairwise distribution is determined in a single experiment. Obviously, all four times would not be done in a single experiment because, a pair of times. So this is really just about the pairwise probabilities, whether I get them from multiple experiments or single experiments.
For each, if I measure P minus plus, then I do that in one run, in which I measure both. Mm-hmm. So in each run, you measure two times, is what I mean.
Right.
Whereas with this one, you do lots of separate experiments and assemble things differently.
Right, you do like a one-time measurement at time one, a one-time measurement at time two, and then you do this maybe single two-time measurement work, but you're doing the first one in a null way so that you have a non-invasiveness.
For the correlator, yes, that's right. Right, but you avoid... this one, the results you get from this one will not satisfy that in general, but the converse is true. Now, what does this look like then at three times? So given this new knowledge at two times, you can now build up an understanding of macrorealism at three times, sort of following what's normally done, the Leggett-Garg inequalities. Well, like at two times, there are now two different ways of doing it. First of all, you can use piecewise NIM, and at three times, it would look like this. You do each pairwise version, as I've just described, using the moments, and then you do that in three different ways, using three different pairs of times, and then you try to see whether or not the whole lot has an underlying joint probability, and that takes you to the three-time Leggett-Garg inequalities. Alternatively, with NIM sequential, you determine this probability by measuring the three-time probability directly and impose a bunch of no signaling in time conditions to ensure that they are non-invasive. So let's take the first one first. So here's how it goes. You measure three temporal correlators non-invasively, which is what you normally do in a Leggett-Garg experiment. In addition, you do three more experiments to measure the averages of Q, so six experiments in total. And then you see, is there an underlying three-time probability which matches all of those? Well, you do this in three steps. I mean, the first step, the single-time probability is easy. Two-time probabilities is what we've seen already. It's this thing. It can be positive. Well, it should be positive for macrorealistic theory. It can be negative. Now, this actually, in a formal sense, it does satisfy no signaling in time. In other words, this thing. But this means is the mathematical conditions for Fine's theorem to hold are met. It doesn't say anything about signaling because you're not doing... Most of the measurements are not actually sequential. So it doesn't mean... that doesn't necessarily mean that the average of Q at time T2 is not disturbed by an earlier measurement. It's just that whenever you measure the average of Q at time T2, you just don't do an earlier measurement. You do assemble things indirectly. So that's the first two steps. And then the third step is to note that we now have an exact mathematical parallel with the Bell case, and you can invoke Fine's theorem, which says that the joint probability exists if and only if a set of 16 inequalities hold, and those consist of the usual Legge-Gog inequalities, four of them, plus a bunch of two-time ones, of which there are 12. And this 16 altogether will guarantee the existence of an underlying probability. So that's a sort of page-long proof to prove this, which is a pretty standard one. So this is essentially it. This is the complete set of two- and three-time inequalities. And it tests, just to sort of summarize that logically, these test a very specific version of macrorealism, which I call, just for convenience, I call it weak macrorealism. It consists of the non-invasiveness in a piecewise way, a bunch of two-time inequalities, plus a bunch of three-time inequalities. And this similarly generalizes to the four-time Legge-Gog inequalities. You basically replace this thing with Legge-Gog 1, 2, 3, 4. Now, the 12 two-time ones provide the extra conditions that elevate the three-time ones from necessary to necessary and sufficient. So it's just adding this bunch of two-time inequalities that just fills the gap. What about testing these experimentally? Well, it's pretty obvious that a lot of existing experiments could be easily modified, because all you need to do is to, in addition to the three correlators, you just need to measure these three averages, which is much easier than measuring the correlators. And in fact, the current Majidi et al. Are currently doing an experiment to do exactly this, to get the three averages as well as the three correlators. In actual fact, a number of existing Legge-Gog experiments already test some of the two-time ones, because they often start with a three-time one and then make a simplification. So they require, for instance, that you take Q1 equals plus 1 to be the initial condition, and that just collapses down to that. So existing experiments, some of them test things like this, some of them test genuine three-time ones. So really, it's really not much of a stretch to actually test all 16. And this is what is now being done. Okay, so that is the end of that bit. Just a few thoughts here on generalizations. You can generalize Legge-Gog inequalities to n times. You do a bunch of pairwise measurements at as many times as you like. The Legge-Gog inequalities look like this, quite simple form, at n times, where plus all possible variants, where you have on the left-hand side an odd number of minus signs. And it is, in fact, surprisingly easy to show that Fine's theorem generalizes to this case. So these can be necessary and sufficient conditions when combined with the two-time ones. A student and I from Imperial, Clement Morby, recently figured out. I noticed recently a paper by Bechtold et al., which determined third-order correlation functions and had suggestions for what Legge-Gog inequalities might look like when you measure higher-order correlation functions. You can show, in fact, that necessary and sufficient conditions for macrorealism, in that case, consist of eight conditions that look something like this, plus different signs. So just a sum of the first order, second order, and third order moments. So mathematically, that's pretty straightforward. So that's interesting to test, to extend current experiments to measure those things. Now, let's look then at how this looks with no signaling in time conditions. So here, I just want to do this, to say this reasonably briefly. Supposing we define non-invasiveness in the sequential way, we measure Q1, Q2, and Q3 in a single experiment. So if I want to do plus, 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 for instance, I just measure them all in a single run, and then do a number of runs that determine all the probabilities of the form P1, 2, 3. Now, we then impose a bunch of conditions of the following form. So supposing I do all three measurements and I sum out the results of the first one, that should be the same as just doing experiments at the second and third time only. Likewise, it should be the same as if I sum out the intermediate measurement. And then finally, there's also a two-time condition of this type. And Koffler and Bruckner and Clemente and Koffler showed that if you satisfy a bunch of conditions of that type, then this does in fact guarantee that this thing is a genuine probability distribution satisfying all the sum rules. Now, this sort of condition tests a much stronger notion of macrorealism, which I call MR strong, which is named sequential with MRPS, but it can also be written out differently. It's just basically this combination of no signaling and time conditions. Now, what can we say about these? Well, these define macrorealism using equalities, whereas Legge-Gog framework defines them using inequalities. What's the difference between these? Well, no signaling in time conditions are checking both NIM and MRPS simultaneously, whereas in the Legge-Gog framework, the piecewise version of NIM holds by design, so it tests MRPS directly. So I had quite a long debate, in fact, with Koffler as to why the Legge-Gog and the no signaling in time conditions, which both seem to test macrorealism, why they were different. These strong conditions are much more stringent than what I call MR weak, because they're also testing non-invasiveness as well as MRPS in the same experiment. So NIM is assumed to hold the Legge-Gog one, so that's the origin of the difference. You can also look at an intermediate version of macrorealism, which is a combination of two-time signaling conditions and three-time Legge-Gog inequalities. In fact, I think some of those were implicit maybe in earlier Legge-Gog tests, so those would also be of interest to test. And there's clearly a logical relationship between these various conditions. Okay, now I've largely avoided saying quantum mechanics throughout this talk, which is very much the spirit of the approach, that you try to think of everything in macrorealistic terms. You can get a bit more insight into some of these things by looking at quantum mechanical formulae. So this is the difference between sequential NIM and piecewise. The sequential NIM essentially involves the standard quantum mechanical measurement formula. You have initial rho project on both sides and so on, where P is just the usual projector onto Q. That is always positive, but it doesn't always satisfy the no signaling condition if I sum out the first time. Now, in NIM piecewise, by contrast, you determine these moments non-invasively, and then the thing that you construct is actually a quasi-probability of this form. So it's just a trace of a single string of projectors with a real part. So it can be negative, but it does at least formally satisfy no signaling in time. But that's just a mathematical formality. It doesn't have any physical significance. This has appeared in decoherent histories. It's often called the Goldstein-Page quasi-probability. It's quite similar to a Wigner function for spin systems. But it is also the two-time Legge-Gog inequality. But this is just to show you what it looks like in quantum mechanics. Now, what's the relationship between these two things? Well, it's quite straightforward to show that the measurement probability and quasi-probability are simply related by the presence of this term, which are essentially interferences involving a commutator. If there was zero interference, then this thing goes away, and since P is always positive, then you must get that Q is always positive. So no signaling in time implies, therefore, that the two-time Legge-Gog inequality, it implies MRPS. But the converse is not true. You can find situations in which MRPS holds, in other words, Q is positive, but that doesn't imply that this thing, it doesn't imply that this thing must be zero, it just needs to be small. So the two-time Legge-Gog inequalities, you can see clearly though here, all that it requires is interference is bounded. So that's always positive. If that's small enough, Q must be positive. Now, similarly, at three times, the strong version of macrorealism involves zero interference, but the weak version, that I think is what is entailed in most Legge-Gog inequalities, allows non-zero interferences. They don't even need to be small, they just need to be bounded in the appropriate way. Now, this is why I feel that this is the more interesting condition. Looking for zero interference is just, it just restricts you very tightly to a very small region of parameter space.
And does that bound as a significance of, is there something interesting if you look at the spin system where you see where the bound is between this thing going to zero or not?
Not It's not anything particularly striking. It depends on the system, really. There doesn't seem anything particularly striking or universal about it. It just needs to be, I mean, you know, you just compute these things and see how small that thing needs to be.
So if I think of the analog for Bell inequalities, there's a point if you have entanglement or not, is when they are violated or not. So I was wondering if there would be some form of analog there.
There's a different situation, which this Q does actually have a Tyrrellson bound, which is minus an eighth. So quantum mechanically, that thing can never be less than minus an eighth. So there might be some connection there, in fact. Well, let me see. No, okay, I'd have to think more about that. But there isn't anything that springs to mind there. All right, so summary so far. What I have sketched out here is that something I don't think was appreciated before in this field, that non-invasiveness comes in at least two different ways, either piecewise or sequential. And there are two corresponding sets of necessary and sufficient conditions. So the piecewise one, you do a number of different experiments and you try to combine the partial snapshots. It's defined in this way. It only requires bounded interference. And it's a direct test of MLPS. And this is what we need to elevate Legit-Gog to a decisive test for macrorealism. By contrast, sequential NIM, you do sequentials are made at three times in a single experiment. It's much stronger, it requires zero interference, and it tests a combination of MLPS and NIM. There have been some experiments that test these sorts of things. They're called coherence witness conditions. So I'm not saying they're not interesting to look at, but I think these just have a more interesting parameter space. Now, that's all on the bulk of the talk. Just the final part, I just want to spend the last 5-10 minutes or so talking about aspects of non-invasive measurements. And there are a couple of ideas here that I'd like to mention. Ideal negative measurements, I was never terribly happy about. So just to remind you, you couple the detector to Q equals plus one. If the detector doesn't register, you therefore say that Q equals minus one. Well, the problem is ideal negative measurements still collapse the wave function. So you do this supposedly non-invasive measurement, and then you check no signaling in time, just purely to check non-invasiveness, not to use it as a macrorealism condition. You find it isn't satisfied. So how can you claim that this is non-invasive, yet a standard condition for invasiveness fails? Well, the issue is that this fails because of wave function collapse, but we think this is true because we're testing the notion that you have a macrorealistic theory. So, again, there's nothing necessarily wrong with that, but what we would like to do in the experiments is to actually have an experimental check that things are really non-invasive, to measure something that would be disturbed if you did a clumsy measurement, basically. So there is actually a way of fixing that. And here's the way. The correlator has the intriguing property that if you diagonalize the density matrix at the first time, it doesn't make any difference. In fact, in simple spin models, the correlator is independent of the initial state. For general models, it doesn't depend on the off-diagonal terms of the initial density matrix. Well, that means that I can do the following. I can actually, supposing I measure the correlator just as normal, and then I repeat the experiment, but this time I do a briefly make a, and you would in general expect to have a superposition at the first time, but I introduce a briefly acting decoherence mechanism. So you could use the ancilla, for instance, to do a blind measurement. That then means that at least formally, the no signaling in time condition then becomes satisfied. So here's a way of getting the correlator in a context in which a signaling condition is actually satisfied, which can then be a check on invasiveness. So if you then check this condition and find that it's violated, it won't be violated due to collapse of the wave function. It will be violated due to a clumsy experiment. So it means that this is what you're trying to weed out all the time in these experiments, is to weed out any sources of inadvertent invasiveness. So that I describe briefly in a recent paper. And this is something that could be implemented extremely easily in existing experiments. For instance, using the ancilla that's often already in there, doing some of the measurements. So that's one idea. Now, a second one, which is currently being implemented or has been implemented already by the group at IQC, is a completely different way of measuring the correlation function. So I wanted to try and get away from ideal negative measurements and do something completely different that had a different set of assumptions. Well, here's the issue, that the correlator is just the average of Q1, Q2, and you can write it rather trivially in this form, either classically or quantum mechanically. The quantum mechanical version just gives you average of these two orderings. And then I make two assumptions. The first assumption is that I know enough about the system that I can identify a velocity variable, Q dot. This is more than you normally assume in Leggett-Gogg tests because you normally have a black box approach where you don't know anything. You don't know the Hamiltonian, don't know the initial state. But in practice, all the experiments are done on a known system, so that's not so problematic. And then you see Q2 minus Q1, that we need in there, is just the time average of the velocity. Now, when do we ever get the time average of anything? Well, the answer is if you actually take this velocity v and weakly couple it to a detector and then just measure it continuously in time, you would get a result that depends on this thing. So it's very easy to dream up a detector model, a weakly coupled, continually interacting detector model that measures that. So we call this the continuous in time velocity measurement. Now, a second assumption is that Q changes sign. Well, Q jumps back and forth between plus and minus one in a macro-realistic model. But if that's the case, then that can complicate things. But you can simplify things a lot by assuming that Q only doesn't change sign at all or changes sign at most once during the time interval. Now, this seems like quite a restrictive assumption, but it turns out it's satisfied quite well in some models, and including regimes in which there's a substantial Leggett-Gogg violation. Now, these two assumptions together mean that you can actually get an approximately non-invasive measurement, and it can be described schematically in the following way. I also call this, by the way, the waiting detector model, because the detector basically waits for Q to change sign, and from that you get the correlation function. So let's suppose, for illustrative purposes, that my Q is just the sine function of some variable x. Then here are the possibilities. So here's x and a function of time, and let's just for simplicity imagine that there's a detector sitting at the origin that jumps from 0 to 1 whenever x crosses, but it's coupled very weakly. So here's what can happen. Either x keeps the same sign, so the ancilla remains in the 0 state, or x changes sign, but the detection is very weak, so most of the history is that the ancilla stays in the 0 state, but some small fraction of them, lambda squared, jump to the 1 state and hence get detected. But the detection causes a back action on the system, which could cause some of the trajectories to cross again, but then and therefore cause the 1 state to go back down to the 0 state and give a false answer. But the issue is that those of order lambda to the 4th compared to the effect, which is of order lambda squared. So the effect of interest, the probability of going to the 1 state, is of this magnitude, but the back action, the invasiveness, is of order lambda to the 4th. So this is approximately non-invasive for sufficiently small lambda. So this is a different way of doing an approximately non-invasive measurement to determine a correlation function, which just involves a different set of assumptions to the usual ideal negative measurements. And this has been successfully implemented by the experiment at IQC, and it gives within errors, essentially the same result as ideal negative measurements. So I'm extremely pleased that this method has actually turned out to be useful. So that is essentially it, in fact. Let me just briefly summarize. So the main result here is to extend legigog conditions for macrorealism to necessary and sufficient conditions, and hence to a more decisive test in macrorealism. And I described a couple of alternative methods for non-invasiveness, and also some simple generalizations of legigog to more times and to higher order correlators. I think all of these are of interest to test experimentally, and I'm very pleased that the group at IQC has actually done some of these already. That's all, thank you. Yep.
I have four questions.
Oh, four questions, excellent.
The first one is when you discuss slash inequality and non-signaling, and then you discuss the temporal analog of it, which is ladybug and non-signaling in time. So I'm wondering that whether the monotony of entanglement has a temporal analog, because entanglement is a spatial correlation, you can consider some monotony of some temporal correlation.
Is the monogamy of temporal correlation?
Yeah.
That's a good question. I don't know. You're normally only looking at... what Legit-Gog tests is the degree to which each pairwise correlation is greater than classical. But let's see. To look at a sort of monogamy, what would be required? Would that be trying to say that the correlation between 1 and 2 and is that, if that's big, then it's at the expense of the correlation between 2 and 3 being smaller or something like that?
The monotony of entanglement is if 2 states are maximally entanglement, this state cannot be maximally entanglement with another state. So I'm thinking if temporal correlation satisfies some similar or maybe adapted version of this.
I think that the short answer is I don't know how they work out, but it's an interesting question. What is true is that this temporal situation actually there's a mathematical map onto spatial entanglement, Choi-Jamiel-Kofsky map, and from which you can take all these temporal questions into spatial entanglement questions, and that would be the way, I think, to address that. But it's an interesting question. I don't know.
Ladybug inequality in fact fails for quantum mechanics. So I'm wondering, you set up the necessary and sufficient condition for microscopic realism. Which one failed? I have read that all of them fails. All the first three you proposed will fail for quantum mechanics, but I do not really understand it. And I'm not sure what's the weak version or the strong version you proposed, which one will fail for quantum mechanics.
I can only partially hear you, but sorry, could you say the question briefly again?
A Ladybug inequality in fact fails for quantum mechanics.
So does what? Fields? Fails for quantum mechanics, that's correct, yes.
Yes, so I'm wondering which condition in the microscopic realism fails for quantum mechanics. I read that all of them will fail.
All the conditions I've written here fail in quantum mechanics for certain conditions. I mean, they don't fail always. So Legit-Gog fails in a non-trivial set of parameters. And it's satisfied for a non-trivial set of parameters. The no signaling in time conditions are only satisfied for a set of measure zero parameters of space. So those no signaling time conditions fail extremely easily. They just need, because they need zero interference to be satisfied.
And the third one is that Ladybug inequality a loss for indefinite color order? Because you mentioned consistent history, for example, inconsistent history, the coherence function can be described by some space-time density matrix in indefinite chordal structure. But I'm not sure whether Ladybug inequality, whether they allow for indefinite chordal order.
Indefinite temporal order?
Chordal order, maybe both space and time, something.
Sorry, what was the last bit? Indefinite
causal
order. Those are not. I've come across attempts to do that. Who was it who was doing that? Kaslav Bruckner, I think. and others will. I always imagine here that there's a clear temporal order, but I think people have explored situations in which that's not true anymore.
The last question is that Bayes inequality can be described by non-local games. So how about the Lady Gaga?
This goes back to the issue I said quite early on. There we go. So Lady Gaga, it only rules out certain types of hidden variable theory, which are essentially mechanical models where you have spins which take definite values and you've got some classical probability for them. If I have a Lady Gaga inequality violation, I can always, if you allow me to invoke Bohm theory with non-locality, then I can explain the Lady Gaga violation. Lady Gaga does not rule out theories of that type unless you have some locality story. I think Ramond had his hand up first as well.
Nope.
No? Okay.
Comment and questions. The comment is regarding the limited Gaga inequality you wrote down for the three-time case.
Yeah.
With the correlators, like the C12, C23, C13. So these are examples of constraints that come from the classical marginal problem. I have a joint distribution over three variables, and then I ask, you know, what sorts of constraints will obtain on pairwise marginals
in that
joint distribution? It seems to me that in the Bell literature, there's sort of an appreciation of that this is formally the mathematical problem that you know, we need to solve. It's
yes.
Derived constraints in the classical marginal problem. But these three measurement cases never arise in a Bell scenario, but they do arise in the contextuality scenario. So Specker in 1957 had this example of correlations, you know, three binary outcome measurements. You can measure any pair of them jointly, but not all three at once.
Right.
And he said, look, there's kinds of correlations that you couldn't explain with a joint distribution, like every pairwise guy is anti-correlated.
Right.
There's no joint distribution. So the inequalities you wrote down are also applied in the study of non-contextuality because, you know, we're interested in cases
with yes.
three measurements. So the comment is just that I've never seen like a guard kind of framed in that way, but it seems to me that it's yet again another example of, you know, these inequalities we derive are just instances of inequalities that come from solving the classical marginal problem. So you could easily, you know, generalize to higher numbers of outcomes and so forth, and,
yep.
and you can just get off the shelf lots of inequalities that have already been derived.
I agree. That's basically been my approach. I mean, as I said at the beginning, the reasons I got into this area, one is from decoherent histories, where I know about histories and probabilities and so on. And the other is when I discovered Fine theorem some years ago. I thought this was just so fascinating. I wanted to understand how you prove it and what are the conditions for matching marginals and so on. So that is very much part of the story. And you can go on. I mean, as I said partway through, there are also these examples where... these generalizations, so when you can make, you know, higher order measurements, what's the Fine theorem then? You can measure more and more, and then you can keep asking, can I still find a probability distribution, and what are the conditions? I mean, there's a big landscape there of interesting things to explore. So, yeah, point is well taken there. That's a good comment.
So now for my question. So I guess, you know, full disclosure, I'm not as persuaded that violations of Lady Gaga inequalities are surprising as I am that violations of Bell inequalities are surprising. You know why? I feel like the justifications of the assumptions that go into deriving these inequalities are better and clearer in the case of Bell. So when Bell says, "I assume local causality, that choices made
right.
over here don't influence the physical reality over here," that's kind of clear. That falls
right.
from relativity. But for example, in this case, with the non-invasiveness assumption,
yes.
even if you grant me that it's a null result type of measurement, I'm still left a little bit cold in the sense that, okay, so you've done a measurement by interacting with the particle, and now you're going to consider the case where, you know, your detector didn't click. Why should I be persuaded that there isn't an action on the particle in that case? I mean, I can easily imagine a physical theory where, oh yeah, there's back action on the particle, even when your detectors don't click. It was a real interaction with the detector. It just seems like there isn't some deep physical principle that tells me that, you know, detectors not clicking must necessarily not disturb the physical state of the system that they've acted on. So at one point you did talk about, you know, maybe we could back up the non-invasiveness assumption with a locality.
Yes.
Right, you know, I entangle two guys, I do the measurement here, and I think of that as a measurement than the other guy. So then you're kind of on firmer ground, you've got local causality.
Absolutely, yes.
So could you, you know, given skeptics like me, could you run the whole argument where every appeal to the assumption of non-invasiveness is justified by local causality?
You need very special circumstances to justify non-invasiveness with causality. I mean, you'd need some special experiment. This is what they're trying to do. Your reservation is, I mean, anyone who thinks deeply about this field has exactly that reservation. So Moroni and Timpson, who I would regard as the arch critics, they say exactly that. They basically say, Bell and Leggett-Gogg, they're not methodologically on a par, because non-invasiveness is a very model-dependent sort of thing. It is not like assuming locality. It's a sort of, you know, they say, as you say, well, you know, if you think of a realistic system, that you might say, well, okay, there isn't an interaction over here when I get a detection over here, but in a realistic device, there's all sorts of stuff going on. There's some field that, you know, even classically, you would think that that's actually going to happen. So it is a big, big problem, I would say. To really nail that down in a convincing way. So it's one reason why I was thinking about other types of measurements like this velocity measurement, which doesn't rely on the null result thing is particularly problematic. But I think the more different methods of non-invasive measurements we can think of, the better. There have been various other assumptions. A number of people have tried other different types of assumptions that get us away from that. But that's probably the central problem of the whole area, actually. It would be really good if someone could. It needs creative input rather than clever experiments or whatever. It needs some really sort of conceptually robust way of convincing us that you really don't disturb the system at the first time when you do a null measurement or similar.
Any other questions?
Yeah. So your critique for ideal negative measurement was the wave function collapses even though you are measuring something null. There is a collapse of the wave function.
Yes.
Am I correct in assuming that collapse of wave function is required for Leggett-Gogg inequalities to violate?
No, it's not. And if you look at the three-time inequality, well, the correlation function doesn't really care what whether or not you're in a diagonal state or not at the first time. So what the three-time inequalities what they actually measure is the growth of superpositions over time. So you could start in a definite, say, definite q equals plus one state at the first time, but the quantum correlators are due to the fact that that state can evolve into an interesting superposition, and that so the violations are all in the quantum transitions that go on. So it's not the collapse of the wave function itself that produces the violation.
The state is in the superposition state. I would presume there would be a collapse of the wave function when you measure it. Until and unless you are in the eigenvector, you choose your measurement to be very careful.
I'm sorry, say that one again.
So you said that the superposition develops during the time of the evolution.
Yes.
And if you measure the system when your system is not the eigenstate of your measurement, then the system wave function will collapse.
At the second time, it will collapse, but that doesn't really matter. It doesn't depend on collapsing the wave function at the first time. So what is true in a lot of these experiments is that if you measure this P, and if you check no signaling in time, it will actually not be set by summing out the first one. it won't be satisfied, which means that there's wave function collapse at the first time. But that collapse is not responsible, not as specifically responsible for the Legge-Gauguin violation. It's actually, what's responsible is actually about the transitions between states at the first time and the second time, from which you get the temporal correlation function. So what's unusual, if you just look at one pair of times and look at the transition amplitude between states at two times, it's not in itself that remarkable, but when you look at this thing at three different pairs of times, that's when you see that there's something a bit funny about the transitions. There are certain approaches to Legge-Gaug, actually just following on from Bob's question, where you avoid non-invasive measurability by you actually just, you know, it's a sort of mock-up of the three-pair time. You prepare the system in state A, measure it in state B. You prepare it in state A, measure it in state C, and then you prepare it in state B and measure it in state C. So you're just doing preparation, measurement, preparation, measurement, preparation, measurement. And those transitions will violate Legge-Gaug type inequalities. So that shows that's the essence of what you're really checking. And it shows it's got nothing to do with wave function collapse or ideal negative measurement. I mean, that's another sort of experiment that you might want to think about looking at, perhaps, if it hasn't been done already.
Just one last question.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. No, I can carry up.
Well, thank you.